Embracing Bitcoin and becoming your own bank is a journey that requires more than an education about Bitcoin and banking and the history of money. You need to, at some point, learn how to safely custody and secure your Bitcoin. And that's a subject that a lot of Bitcoiners and people who are new to Bitcoin are scared of and don't understand nearly well enough. Our guest has joined us today to share his painful journey, hodling Bitcoin for over 10 years and doing almost everything right and coming away in the end with nothing. Rick Messett is the chief of marketing at the Bitcoin Way, which is a Bitcoin cybersecurity specialty firm helping people do everything that they possibly can to make sure their Bitcoin is stored and secured as safely as possible. I'm Scott Dietles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace, and it's helping people understand how it will help them. So if you're interested to learn something about the most critical part of keeping your Bitcoin safe, stick around. Today's is a great story. Welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. We are joined this week by Rick Messett, and a very important conversation about a very long Bitcoin journey that became famous over the last year or so, I suppose. Rick, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Scott. Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Your Bitcoin story goes back a lot longer than it's been in the public eye. You were in Bitcoin very early. Maybe before we get into it too far, can you talk a little bit about your how you found Bitcoin in your early days?
Sure, yeah. I guess I've been into Bitcoin for probably more than 25% of my life now. It's kind of weird to think about that. You start feeling pretty old, right? Like, wow, I was a much younger man when I first discovered Bitcoin. And the best explanation for why, well, it was me and my dad actually that got into Bitcoin. The main explanation there is, look, you know, I was raised to be pretty distrustful of governments and that sort of thing from a young age. You know, my dad, he very much thinks for himself, always has done. So, you know, even before Bitcoin came on the scene, he'd already sat me down when I was younger and explained to me, you know, that fractional reserve banking is a complete scam, that they create money out of thin air, that the whole game is rigged against you. And you know, we understood the problem with money. We understood that there was this big scam. And, you know, I wouldn't call my dad a gold bug, but, you know, he was very interested in storing his wealth in anywhere except fiat currency. So, you know, kind of grew up in that kind of mindset. And I think that served us well when we did stumble across Bitcoin, because for me, the best way to get someone to understand Bitcoin and what it's all about is, I don't think you can properly understand the solution to a problem unless you fully understand the problem first. Otherwise, it's not going to make a whole great deal of sense to you, right? So understanding the problem was one part of it. And then my dad's a software engineer and has been, you know, for his whole life. So, I mean, he can tell you some pretty interesting stories, right? Like, you know, he started with like punch cards and all this sort of stuff. Like, what is it? Microsoft System 360, and, you know, then worked his way through, you know, C++ and PHP and all these different software engineering languages. And he's always, well, not always. He used to work for a bank in his early part of his career, but for most of his career, he just worked for himself, you know, building software, doing his own thing. He likes to be quite independent. So anyway, you know, fast forward to sort of 2014, around that sort of time, late 2013, early 2014 is when we discovered Bitcoin and got really interested in it. And the experience was wild, right? It was really fun because it was like this shared interest that me and my dad had, right? So like, you know, some father sons, like, they go fishing. I mean, we like going fishing, but like, this was our little thing, our little baby. And yeah, we would spend for months, we'd spend hours on the phone to each other trying to make sense of it. Like, what are the implications? You know, what does this mean for the banks? And, you know, back then there was a big focus on like, how is it going to disrupt Western Union for remittances? Like, that was the big thing. And yeah, just got more and more and more obsessed with it. And yeah, you know, haven't lost interest since, really. That's really our origin story.
Yeah, it's amazing for me. You know, I'm like a class of 2020 Bitcoiner, so I'm always fascinated to hear the evolution of people that were involved much earlier. And because, you know, there was such a greater degree of unknown, right? At that time, you know, it's not that far, much further back. You know, Bitcoin's not very old, right? So, but 2013, 2014, 2015, Block Wars 2017, a lot of uncertainty as the thing sort of continues to just trudge along and prove itself out.
It's wild. I mean, you know, one of the things is you get like a really sort of good quality perspective the longer you stay around Bitcoin, right? I think that helps a lot. I mean, you know, I said this in my talk in Prague, but I think we were actually really quite lucky to find Bitcoin when we did, because we found Bitcoin even before ETH became a thing. Right. And what that meant is all those hours we spent on the phone talking about Bitcoin, there were no distractions. You know, you didn't have all of the scam coins. You didn't have Ethereum, no NFTs, like none of this nonsense. So, you know, it would be quite easy for me to sit here and sort of pretend like, oh, we figured out Bitcoin was, you know, superior to all these other blockchains or whatever because we're so smart. But I think actually the reality was that because we had the time to get to grips with Bitcoin and understand it properly before the scams came up, it became really easy to sort of take the model of a scam token like Ethereum and apply it against the knowledge we got against Bitcoin and very quickly understand the key differences, you know, and why this just isn't a comparable asset or whatever you want to call ETH, right? It's just not a comparable thing. So there's a lot of benefits to that. And yeah, you know, hanging around it for so long as well is it's really useful. It keeps you, I think, a bit more grounded. So, for example, you know, when the ETFs came out, the whole Twitter timeline was, you know, Bitcoin will be $300,000 within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and you can feel the hype and the energy, and everyone's getting excited. But once you've been around for a while, you realize like there's always hype. There's always the next thing. You know, I remember when El Salvador adopted Bitcoin, which is amazing, right? It's an incredible thing. But I remember as well, just like everyone else, thinking, all right, well, by next week, there'll be 7 other countries. This thing's going to $10 million a coin. And, you know, typically it just takes a little bit longer to play out. So maybe a bit more time makes you take a more calm approach to Bitcoin. You realize like, this can make you very wealthy, but it's not a get rich quick scheme. It's a don't get poor over time scheme. And well, yeah, your purchasing power will go up as well. So if you can hang around 5-10 years and use this as your savings account, you know, a way to accrue wealth, then yeah, on a 5-10 year time horizon, you'll do well. And maybe that makes it easy to block out the noise, because apart from that, nothing else is that relevant, really.
So you guys started buying Bitcoin at a probably pretty low prices that early on, and you were accumulating coins. And
that's right, yeah. So it's funny, like we could probably go through old wallets and try and figure out exactly what we paid, but you know, I remember certainly we bought some Bitcoin under $100. I can't remember exactly when. Probably the bulk of it was, you know, around $200-$300. So yeah, I mean, it's so funny to talk about that now. $300 for a whole Bitcoin just sounds just ludicrous. And I mean, holding something that increases in value by 40,000% or something, that's a wild, wild ride, you know, and holding through all these bull markets and bear markets. I mean, the bear markets are brutal. You know, there would have been points where, you know, I'd be in my mid to late 20s, sitting on $500,000 worth of Bitcoin and thinking like, you know, well, you know, you're in your 20s, you're thinking, right, it's not going to be long till I've got the yachts and the houses, you know, all that fiat stuff. And then you watch your wealth like draw down from like this 500K sort of number back down to like 40K. And yeah, man, when you're in your 20s, if that's the first time you've been through something like that, it really does feel like someone's kicked you in the stomach. You know, it's people say you need to develop like diamond hands and this sort of thing. And there's some truth in that, like you're not going to have a good time if you don't have conviction. And, you know, I found that difficult, but why I held on and didn't get scared off is because we'd spend that time to understand what Bitcoin was. You know, the conviction was unshakable. So regardless of the price, I knew that I wanted Bitcoin and more Bitcoin and all this sort of stuff. But it's easy to see why new people into the market have such a difficult and challenging experience, because the news cycle's always, let's take the Nashville conference of the moment as an example. I don't doubt that like a lot of people might have got really excited and maybe bought some Bitcoin on leverage, expecting this thing to rip when Donald Trump speaks about it and all this sort of stuff. And if you stay looking at the short term like that, you're going to have a really, really bad time, because it wouldn't even surprise me if it dumps 20% over the next 2 or 3 weeks. Like, of course that could happen. And market makers, if they see a lot of people going like long on leverage and stuff, you know, like they say, bulls make money, bears make money, and pigs get slaughtered. So if you get greedy and you're trying to get rich next week, yeah, you're gonna struggle.
Yeah, and a point you made there that I think is interesting and worth reflecting on are a lot of people wish they would have found, or you know, comment on what they would have done if they would have bought Bitcoin at $100 or whatever. And I think the reality is almost nobody would have held through to now, and because of the, you know, the euphoria, or you know, just having made a lot of money. So you know, when Bitcoin was a lot less certain 10 years ago, and it goes up from 1,000 to 20,000, like it's almost impossible to pull a 20x trading a stock. And so most people, I think, who would have been up a lot probably would have sold a lot.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, it's I think I probably realize now that actually holding the coins for that long is quite a rare thing. Like a lot of people who are in early probably sold, and we never did. I mean, let me caveat that. Like I sold some Bitcoin along the way, you know, like life, you know, your transmission on your car goes and you need a new exhaust or unexpected expenses. It was nice to have this Bitcoin there that when I needed to access some funds, I could. But by and large, you know, the plan was to, well, you know, I was earning in fiat and spending in fiat, and any spare money would go towards Bitcoin, and then just ride it out. And once you've been through a couple of bear markets, you do become more and more immune to the price volatility. And the more you understand the economics, for me, it's this realization that Bitcoin is the best yardstick for value. And the price of it in dollars are a terrible yardstick for value, right? Because they lose value so quickly. It's so manipulated. If you stick around long enough, you go deep enough down the rabbit hole, you realize that the value of everything should be measured in nothing but Bitcoin. And, you know, look at the price of housing versus Bitcoin over the last 10 years. You know, if you can move beyond worrying about what your stack is worth in dollars, then you've really kind of, you've crossed the chasm of understanding at that point for me, because I only care about how many Bitcoin I've got. I'm not interested in how many dollars I can exchange them for, you know?
Absolutely. This relates to you guys as well. And I think the other point about early Bitcoiners is wallets have gone through a massive evolution. And, you know, custody is the subject of this conversation. But I think people who are getting into Bitcoin now or newer Bitcoiners probably don't understand how things were 10 years ago, or, you know, it's a address generated, it's on a piece of paper. I think things were a lot to be worked out. And I've met other Bitcoiners in my travels who I know one personally has a wallet with 300 Bitcoin in it that he hasn't been able to open since 2014. And so a lot of people is like, how could you not be rich if you were buying Bitcoin at $80? But man, there was just a lot of different pitfalls of a sort of a more Wild West time.
Most of the Bitcoiners that I know that have been around for a long time will have some story somewhere of some grievous mistake, or, you know, like locking themselves out of their wallet by losing some critical data, or, you know, falling for some phishing scam. It could be like any number of things that parted them from their Bitcoin. It's almost funny, like, it almost becomes like a bit of a rite of passage in some ways, you know, like they say, pain is the best teacher. It's not always the most fun way to learn something, but you know, you're right. And you know, what's interesting though, is I don't know if I would necessarily say that now is any easier than it was then, because the hardware is better and more accessible and is developed, and the software and the wallets are better and more developed. But the problem is, I think, especially for new people, is they think that like all hardware wallets do the same thing, or that they're all as secure as each other. And the truth is, you know, not all hardware wallets are. For example, I'm not going to sort of get into naming any names or anything, but there's certain hardware wallets that I wouldn't touch with a barge pole. And there's some hardware wallets that I would be happy to use. So, you know, if you're new to this, there's real risk that, you know, you go and you choose a self-custody solution, but actually it's very easy to make mistakes because, you know, you're working with businesses. They all do marketing. They all want to convince you they have the best product. And if you're not technically minded, appraising the pros and cons of each setup and each hardware wallet and each software wallet is not easy. So there's more tools, but that's a double-edged sword, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a really just critical topic for Bitcoin, I think, because of the importance of understanding the relevance of self-custody, of being in possession of your own Bitcoin. But it's scary for people. And this is one of the big things that people who are outsiders to Bitcoin or you know, getting into it, you know, it makes people uneasy. The idea that of being your own bank, as cool as it is also really foreign and scary.
It's a paradigm shift. You know, if you look at the world we inhabit now, you know, everything has moved towards convenience, right? So we don't grow or produce our own food so much anymore. Whereas 50 years ago, most people where I'm from would have like a little herb garden at the very least, or, you know, be growing tomatoes and stuff like this. And we outsource almost everything today, right? For the convenience, the speed. And yeah, this idea that the buck stops with you, I think is pretty foreign to people. And I don't actually think it's a bad thing that people are intimidated by it, because if you're not and you feel really comfortable, that's maybe a good sign that you haven't maybe taken it quite seriously enough, right? Because, hey, listen, you know, if you want to be your own bank, that also means that you're the head of security at this bank, right? And I don't know about you, Scott, but like if I couldn't apply for the job role of head of security at a major bank because I don't have that skill set. You know, it's probably a guy with 45, 50 years experience in cybersecurity and a CV that's really serious. So I think a lot of people are right to be cautious, not to be put off this, what they should do, but, you know, take it as seriously as if you'd just been given the job of head of security at BlackRock, right? That's how serious this is, because if you don't take it seriously, you're likely to make a big mistake at some point along your journey.
So, yeah, I would love to talk a little bit about your own personal story, which you have done a really great job of sharing in spite of how difficult it must have been. And I think that, like, maybe just to preface it, this is, you know, what I love about how you do this is it's something that was going to happen to somebody, and it happened to happen to you. And you've really turned this into an opportunity to help a lot of people take this as seriously as they should. So yeah, tell us your story.
Yeah, thanks, man. Like, I appreciate that. You know, I'm trying to make the best out of a bad situation, really. But, you know, for the listeners, I'll sort of just give the brief version of what happened. But basically, we'd huddled this Bitcoin for 10 long years. You know, it appreciated in value by something like 40,000%. You know, we were on Cloud Nine, feeling pretty happy with ourselves. You know, we'd made a good decision. We'd avoided all the scams. We'd avoided all the exchanges blowing up. You know, on paper, everything's looking pretty sweet, right? However, you know, our story took the most ridiculous bad turn. It's almost like a bad Netflix special, right? Because after 10 years, me and my dad decided we're going to go to El Salvador, almost like a bit of a celebration, right? 10 years, a long time. We'll go on a father-son trip of a lifetime to El Salvador. We went to the Adopting Bitcoin conference. We're having a whale of a time. And actually, me and my dad, we've been working on this Bitcoin Lightning app for sort of 4 or 5 years, right? Just kicking this idea around and playing with it, mainly in our free time. And we went to the conference, and on the last day, because we'd seen so many amazing talks with people building all their projects, we're all like fired up, motivated, right? So We get back to our Airbnb in El Salvador, and we had to fund some lighting channels to do some testing on this thing that we'd built. And I can still remember it. You know, my dad, you know, he just said, well, I don't want to swear all over your podcast, right? But he said one word that begins with an F. And I said, well, you know, what's up? And he just said, look, Rick, I've been hacked. All of the Bitcoin is gone. And yeah, it was a sizable amount, you know, 25 Bitcoin that we'd held for a long time. Yeah, it was gone. I mean, at first it was a crazy situation because we're pacing around this Airbnb, if you can picture it, you know, thinking things like my dad had bought a new laptop like a couple of months earlier, and he'd like, you know, he's a software developer, so he knows what he's doing. He's got backups everywhere, and he'd like reconfigure things and move things around. And at first he was like, well, hang on. Then maybe I've moved something, or, you know, this is a different set of key. You know, you're just like, you're in this desperate thing. You can't quite believe it. You're trying to figure out why it can't possibly be true. Just bargaining with yourself, really. You know, and then I asked him to send me the transaction IDs of these payments moving around. And once I put them into a Block Explorer, and I saw the extent of the transactions and where they'd been, it was really obvious that this wasn't us like moving Bitcoin around and reconsolidating. Like, this was something, it had been stolen. And I mean, look, you know, I thought to myself as well before this podcast with you, Scott, as well, I should maybe open up a little bit more about just how brutal and savage that was. Because I really want to drive the message home to people, you know, like if you look at my talks, I tell a lot of jokes and, you know, I make fun of myself quite a bit and stuff like that. But in all honesty, there's an element of that that is just like a bit of a defense mechanism, right? It's a classic self-deprecating British sense of humor, right? But the truth is, I mean, you know, I was absolutely in a state. It's hard to really explain when you've huddled for 10 years. You know, you've obviously imagined what you're going to do with that money and how you're going to use it to help your friends and your family out and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, having been like, I guess, maybe on the spectrum of conspiracy theorist, or that's what I've been told for the last 10 years, you know, I am genuinely concerned about the state of the world and what's going to happen as fiat money dies. And I'm actually like not a flashy guy at all, right? Like, I wasn't interested in Lambos or anything. The main reason that I think one of the big reasons I huddled for so long was that I wanted to set some friends and family free. You know, like I have friends that, you know, work hard, have kids and, you know, they're swimming upstream like everybody else, like struggling to get by despite doing all the right things. And I don't know, man, maybe I've got some weird sort of, you know, savior complex, but actually, you know, the reason I didn't sell at 20,000 and the reason I didn't sell at 70,000 was because like this was a bigger thing, you know. I wanted to make sure everyone around me was safe. So when we discovered the Bitcoin was stolen, it's really hard to process, you know, because you feel like you've let everybody around you down. You feel like you've let yourself down, and you feel a bit like a fraud, actually. You know, that's one thing I've been having to deal with is, you know, I've been in Bitcoin a long time, and to make what were really quite silly mistakes with how we secured it, you know, to come then back out to the, in front of the Bitcoin community is a hard thing. I mean, you'll know, Scott, like it's a pretty ruthless place in terms of, I mean, I love it, right? Don't get me wrong. I love it that Bitcoiners are like, they want the truth, right? Straight away, like no messing. But to come out and sort of be open was hard. It's brutal. I mean, man, you know, I was about to get married. My wedding was booked in 2 or 3 months. So, you know, imagine calling your fiance and saying, I've lost everything. You know, we want to start a family. You know, I hadn't bought a house yet, for example. Like I was living in, man, I'm that meme, right? Like I was living in one of the roughest parts of Scotland, in a very small flat on maybe one of the most dingy, horrible. Yeah, like, because it was super cheap. Like, I'm a hardcore hodler. I'm like that guy in a spacesuit lying on a mattress on the ground because I was willing to delay my gratification in probably a way I think most people wouldn't. You know, my monthly expenses were $300 or $400 a month, which is what blows people's minds because I was just on this one mission. So, yeah, realizing that that's just vanished, like, and instantly, right? Like instantly, you know, you feel sick to your stomach. You got to call all these people and explain what's happened. It's just brutal, just brutal. And, you know, I'm in a much better headspace now, but I'm not gonna try and bullshit people or try, you know, there's so much of that on Bitcoin Twitter, right? We all eat raw eggs and drink raw milk and we're all like hard as nails and well, you know, fine. But there's a lot of bluster there. Like, you know, I still have days today where, you know, it hits you sometimes. You know, all of these plans that you had have gone to nothing. You literally start with this blank piece of paper again. And yeah, believe me, like you don't want to experience that if you can possibly avoid it. So I've probably not even done it justice, but yeah, it's a savage experience.
And so you guys, it wasn't like you were using an app on your phone. You know, maybe if you could talk a little bit about, because actually you probably were even doing more than most Bitcoiners who are using a cold storage wallet are doing now.
I mean, yeah, you know, like here's the thing. So like a few people like were trolling me saying, how come you don't use a hardware wallet and all this sort of stuff? And the truth is we did have hardware wallets and we did use hardware wallets. But this really kind of shows that there's still so much more education needed in the space, right? Because a hardware wallet is like a signing device, basically, you know, rather than something that necessarily stores your Bitcoin, right? Because Bitcoin's just on a ledger, right? It's not a file that moves around. And we had hardware wallets, but we also needed to come up with a solution to store our seed phrase, right? And what we did is, well, like a lot of people in the early days, it was on paper. And then after a while, you think, well, this is stupid, right? Like paper is flammable. And if your house floods, then that's a problem. So I think what we did, well, I know what we did is my dad's a software engineer, right? So he writes software all the time, which means that, you know, he runs applications now for like online ordering services and stuff. So he's very much in the habit of backing up all his files. You know, you could throw all of his laptops in the sea. He'd buy new devices and be back where he was within a day because he'd be able to reload everything from his backups. So, you know, we took what seemed like the obvious solution, which was, well, we'll put the seed phrases into a password manager. Now, I should be really clear about what I mean by that. We didn't use like a service like LastPass where it lives on the cloud. There was no third party involved at all. We used an open source password manager called KeePass, which lives on your device. No one else can access it. It's still self-custody. And we put our seed phrases in there. And what we did is then we encrypted this KeePass file. So you couldn't access it unless you had a password and all that sort of thing. But obviously leaving it on a local machine is a problem because if the laptop dies or, you know, you put it on a hard drive and that dies, then again, you've total loss. So, you know, being a software developer, my dad's logic would have been, well, we need to back it up so that we can access it, you know, regardless of what happens to our devices. So I've heard a lot worse setups, right? Like here's a couple of messages I think are important. Number one, it's really stupid to store your seed phrase online full stop. That was a mistake, right? Backing this thing up to a cloud service, big, big mistake, right? But what really, really let us down was the password we used to encrypt this KeePass file. That's the real part where we fell over because that password was like laughably weak, like ridiculously weak to the point that I would imagine people probably brute forced it in, you know, half an hour, an hour. But the thing that's really interesting, I think, about the story is, you know, why were we targeted by hackers in the first place? And I think this is important for people to hear because we bought our coins back on Mt. Gox in 2014. And obviously, like famously, Mt. Gox got hacked. But the hackers didn't just steal the Bitcoin. They also got access to all the KYC data for that exchange. And that included, well, law enforcement told us later that means that on lists on the dark web, there's my full name, my dad's full name, our home addresses, phone numbers, emails, everything, all the KYC data. And that's pretty terrifying. So I can't prove this, but my guess is that this hack wasn't random. My guess is that our names were floating around on these lists. The data from Mt. Gox would have shown exactly how much Bitcoin we'd bought, how much we'd sent off the exchange, all the addresses we used. So it was kind of out there that we were sitting on a nice stack of Bitcoin. and all our names. So, you know, I think we were probably targeted. You know, they've gone, looked up my dad. He's a software engineer, so you will find information about him online, right? He's been doing that a long time. And then they've gone and they found his cloud storage, and our passwords weren't strong enough. They've brute forced their way in, and then brute forced their way into the KeePass file. So it's a mixture of really stupid decisions on our part that, you know, we should have corrected over the 10-year course. At some point, we should have gone, this isn't good enough, and made it better. But I also want people to really understand that KYC data is a real problem. Like, it's a threat to you. I don't call it know your customer. I call it kill your customer. Because here's the scary truth, and something that still keeps me up at night a little bit, is we were hacked, right? Not physically, digitally, right? Someone got into our systems and got the seed. But like, my dad's, you know, he's almost 70 years old now, right? We don't live together or anything like that. Our address details were leaked by Malgop. And hey, you know, 25 Bitcoin, what's that? It's almost like a couple million dollars or something now. There are lots of people in the UK that would come around with knives and guns and balaclavas to try and relieve you of that. So one thing I hope people take away is that, you know, if you're buying Bitcoin on an exchange where you've given up all your names, your details, your passport, all of that ID stuff, there's a non-zero chance that that could come and bite you in the ass later down the line, because there will be more hacks. There will be more leaks. You know, one story I'm not sure everyone is aware enough about is like what happened when the Ledger data got leaked, right? So Ledger, famous hardware wallet manufacturer, pretty popular as well, like one of the bigger names. Well, I can't remember when, must have been a couple of years back maybe, but all their customer data got leaked. And now imagine that if I'm a criminal, knowing the name and address of everybody who's bought this hardware wallet to store their Bitcoin on, that's scary. And, you know, in Sweden, it was a huge problem, because in Sweden, as I understand it, the rules are that if I have your name, I can go and look up your address legally, right? Like, that's a thing. So imagine I combine these two bits of information. Customers in Sweden, I know they've bought a hardware wallet. I can take their name and look up their address. And the result was that, you know, in Sweden, people got tied up and kidnapped and beaten for their seed addresses. So this is a real problem. You know, people, I never took my personal information as seriously as I should have. And it was a real wake-up call that we'd understood Bitcoin. We'd understood that you absolutely have to take self-custody, because we already hated the banks. I wasn't about to use the exchange as a bank. The blind spot was cybersecurity. You know how I mentioned, like, if you're the bank, then you're also the head of security. We just hadn't approached that. Like, this is something that you have to spend a lot of time on. It has to be perfect. You get no second chances. You only get one go to get this right. And we were way too casual about that, I think is really what happened.
I was personally on that Ledger list that got leaked. And as a result of that, I have received sort of countless really sophisticated email phishing scams, phone calls from all kinds of people, you know, telling you your wallet's been compromised, you need to supply this information. And, you know, like, fortunately for me, like, I knew enough to, nothing so far has been a problem for me, but it's easy to imagine a lot of people, they think they're getting a call from Ledger. You know, you can see how these things go.
It's scary, man. I think it's going to get worse, actually, probably before it gets better. You know, I mean, at the moment, like, think how many hackers, their focus is on targeting big companies, right? Like, do you remember, like, Sony got hacked like quite a while ago now, but like, hackers would target these big companies. If Bitcoin does go to $1 million a coin and becomes like hugely valuable, I just think about the incentives of it. If I'm a hacker, is it going to be easier for me to hack into a company like Sony that spends no doubt millions of dollars a year on their cybersecurity setup? Or is it going to be easier to target John, who is just a one-man band down the road, who I know has a stack of Bitcoin? I think their attention will shift towards individuals. And, you know, it's a little bit late for me now, you know, being a public Bitcoiner, I guess. But if I could do it all again, let's say I was going to start my Bitcoin journey today, I'd be telling people, like, listen, you know, don't talk about it, don't post about it online. You know, try and buy non-KYC Bitcoin if you can. Don't use an exchange. Like, try and accumulate Bitcoin, but do it as quietly as you possibly can. And after my experience, oh God, you know, I scroll through Twitter, man, and I see people who are doxxed, you know, their picture, their full name. They even talk about their family and their kids. And, you know, every couple of weeks, I see them posting a screenshot of how much Bitcoin they just bought. And I just think, like, I get it, right? Like, you get some likes, you get some impressions, like, it's all fun and that sort of thing. But, like, if you've got a family to look after, every time you make a post like that, you are increasing the risk for them. And I really don't think it's worth it. So, yeah, lots of lessons learned.
Absolutely. And I totally share the sympathy. I think about this all the time, too. Like, it's important that Bitcoin has faces so that other people can relate to real people. Whether or not it's the right, you know, calling to be one of those people is something that remains to be seen, I guess, for all of us. And I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, you know, because I'm all about, you know, I've been giving talks on Bitcoin since 2014, 2015, right? And you know, I'm glad I did. You know, I probably orange-pilled quite a lot of people in that time. And, you know, that's how it's going to spread. You know, we mentioned that people don't understand money, and that's a big problem. We have to get out there and do the education. I guess what I would say to influencers and public people out there is, like, if you're going to do that, then this idea that you're the head of security becomes even more important, because you are actively drawing attention to yourself. And you might know as well, I started doing some work with the Bitcoin Way recently, and talking to Tony, who is a cybersecurity professional, you know, for 20 odd years. And oh boy, wow. Like, my blind spot was way bigger than I even realized, you know? So he's talking about things like, where do you buy your charging cables from, Rick? And I'm like, Amazon, like everybody else. You know, and he said, okay, and how do you choose them? And I'm like, well, I go for the best price. It's a charging cable. It's a commodity, right? So I'd buy any old one. He just looks at me like I'm a total idiot. And in many ways, he's right, because he says, well, you do realize, like, some of these ones that might come out of China or from dodgy manufacturers, you know, in the little end bit of the charger, apparently some of these things can have, like, miniature servers in them. So as soon as you connect your phone to it, boom, off it goes, starts collecting all your data, extracting information, watching what you're doing. And I think what I've come to realize, right, is that securing your Bitcoin is no different to securing any other critical piece of information. That's all it is. That's all it is, right? So cybersecurity and protecting critical information is not a new idea. People have been doing it for decades. So Bitcoin is no different. Your seed phrase is just some data that you need to secure. And if you think that just buying a hardware wallet and a steel plate is going far enough, I'm here to, I guess, tell people that it just isn't. You know, How's your data security? How's your privacy? How secure is your home network? How secure is your phone? Are you using open source like Graphene OS on your phone, or are you letting Google track everything? Even stuff down to, you know, you send a Bitcoin transaction, and like everyone, you want to know when it confirms. So you take the transaction ID, and what do? You go to Google, you open up a Block Explorer, and you paste in the transaction ID. Well, you know, unless your cybersecurity and privacy is really, really good, you've just told Google a whole lot of information. You know, they see the transaction ID. They can see the address it came from. You're basically telling the whole world, this is my Bitcoin. This is where you can go and find it. This is everything I own. So yeah, it's been a wake-up call that, like, unless you're a cybersecurity professional, it might actually make sense to go and get some training, or you know, if you're not going to pay for some training and you're going to teach yourself, which you can, there's loads of great info out there. You need to commit a serious amount of hours, not just to understanding the economics, but also understanding how you're going to keep it safe, you know?
Yeah, and I think this is such a critical aspect of the message, where it's not to dissuade anybody from going down the road. It's to just be properly aware of the seriousness and the depth of this aspect of it. And a lot of people, like myself included, I'm not really what I would consider a techie person. Like, that stuff really doesn't interest me. But there is just a certain amount of stuff you need to be educating yourself on just so that you're properly, you know, prepared to participate in this thing.
Absolutely. It's so easy to make mistakes. I mean, even things down to like UTXO management and not having loads of little, you know, it's difficult out there. You know, there's lots of messages that say you should DCA a small amount of Bitcoin every week and stuff. And hey, look, you know, that's not terrible advice at all. I like the sort of DCA strategy. But, you know, if you're going to withdraw that every single time, like $20 at a time of Bitcoin into your wallet, if you don't understand UTXO management, then in 5 years' time, you might find that all your Bitcoin is unspendable, because you've withdrawn it in tiny little chunks, you have tiny little UTXOs. And if the network fees are more than the value of the Bitcoin in this little UTXO, then it's essentially unspendable. So there's so many ways you can get yourself in a mess. And I think, like, the way I see it now is funny, like why I work with the Bitcoin way now is, like, it couldn't be any more crystal clear to me how essential a service like that is. Because look, you know, I love playing golf. Right. And if I want to get better at golf, I go and hire a golf pro and I go down to the driving range and he teaches me and helps me get better at golf. If I want to learn karate or jujitsu or anything, right, it's so much better if you have a teacher. I could try and learn jujitsu on YouTube, but I get a feeling that if I got in a fight and I tried to use it, might not be so effective, right? So yeah, I think the message should be, I see it a lot on Twitter, right? People post things like, in 2024, it's inexcusable not to have your Bitcoin secured. It's so easy now. And I don't want to put the message out there that it's difficult, because I think difficult is the wrong word, but completely new to you, yeah, maybe. In the way that, you know, if your taps in your bathroom stop working or a pipe bursts a leak, unless you're a plumber, it's maybe not sensible to go and try and fix that yourself. So what do? You call the guy with expertise. But so many people are getting into Bitcoin now. And part of the job of getting into Bitcoin is knowing how to secure critical data. And the truth is, if you're not a cybersecurity professional, that's a big ask. It's a big task. And to go into it thinking that 5 YouTube videos are going to give you all the skills you need to do this to the nth degree, it does a disservice to cybersecurity professionals, right? Who spend their whole careers learning how to secure data. So I don't want to put people off. I just want them to take it like super, super seriously.
So many good points there. So for people, maybe just tell us a little bit about the Bitcoin way and what is the offering?
Yeah, I mean, I love the Bitcoin way. And, you know, so I'm doing a bit of marketing work for them now. You know, my thing is like marketing and sales. So yeah, it's weird. Like, they were one of the first people who called me after I posted on Twitter about the hack, and Tony got in touch and just really wanted to help and see if there was anything salvageable from the situation, which unfortunately, you know, there wasn't. But, you know, then we hit it off. We got talking. You know, if you know Tony's story, you should get him on the podcast, by the way, because his story is, I think, even crazier than mine, right? Because he got wiped out in Lebanon by the financial crisis. You know how we all talk about hyperinflation and what it might look like? Well, Tony lived through it, right? So, you know, he lost everything in that financial crisis. I just lost everything. So we just really hit it off, right? Like, almost kindred spirits in a way. Yeah. And so I started doing a little bit of marketing with them. I started off just by like writing their newsletter every week and that sort of thing, and helping those guys out. And then slowly, you know, we got more and more involved, like working together. And now I really understand their services. And the way I think I would break it down is, the first job that they help you with is securing your Bitcoin properly, right? And what I mean by that is, you know, not just saying buy this hardware wallet and take your Bitcoin off the exchange. They will walk you through it properly. And they will actually be helping you by making the right hardware recommendations. So instead of you thinking, oh, you know, should I buy this one or this one or this one or this one? What Tony does is he's gone and he has tested everything to the absolute limit, so that he has curated the right resources for you. And he'll take you to a point where you've secured the money, but you also will do things like set up and run a full Bitcoin node, so that, you know, when you're making transactions, you're not connecting to any third party node. You know, it's a completely trustless model. And what they do so well is they take people like, I've seen them take like a guy in his 80s, right? Knows nothing about computers. And within a few weeks, his setup and security is really, really quite robust to the point where this guy could travel to another country, make a Bitcoin transaction, let's say at a Bitcoin conference, but still do it through his own node that he's connected to over Tor from his phone, which is protected by all this cybersecurity. He might even be running like Graphene OS and stuff like this, right? So it's just they do it really, really properly. Whilst I'm not the most technical guy, having been around for 10 years, I know what good looks like and I know what bad looks like. And, you know, I can verify for anyone listening that like these guys do it the proper way. And I love them, right? They only accept Bitcoin. They only pay suppliers in Bitcoin. Like these guys, they're not joking around. Like it's Bitcoin only. You can't pay them in dollars. They're not interested because they live on a Bitcoin standard. They're fully sovereign. And they're just training people to become sovereign as well. And so once they've got you secured and your Bitcoin safe, then the next part of the process is to get all your devices safe. So, you know, how secure is your laptop? How secure is your mobile phone? How much are you being tracked? Are you using VPNs and obfuscating all of your traffic? And again, similar to the hardware wallets, you could type into Google, which VPN should I use? And you'll have 25 options. But not all VPNs are built the same. Some of them might log everything you're doing. Some of them might have backdoors to governments that reveal things you don't want. Some of them might be straight up scams and install malware on your device and that sort of thing. So having a team of people that have done the curation process already and say, look, these are the VPNs you want. This is the setup you want, and walk you through. It's actually quite amazing how in just a very short period of time, you can take someone from being like no idea what they're doing to being actually, the funny thing is, probably better set up than some of your favorite influencers that you see that have been talking about Bitcoin for years. Like that's the truth. And then the final piece of the puzzle is they secure the money, they secure your devices. And then what they will help you with is doing things like securing Plan B citizenships, right? So it's going the whole hog here. So, you know, whatever happens, your money's safe, your data and your privacy's safe. And, you know, in a shit hits the fan situation, you can jump on a plane and take you and your family and your wealth and everything and get out of Dodge. And that really appeals to me because, like, I'm not done. Like, there's no way I'm leaving. But this time we're doing it right. And this time I'm going to go all the way. Like I'm going to leave my home country. I'm going to get second citizenship. I'm going to completely secure all my devices. I'm going to de-Google myself. I'm sick of the government tracking me and knowing what I'm up to. I'm going to get rid of, I run an Android phone, but I'll get set up with Graphene OS and start caring about my privacy. And then I will probably move to a jurisdiction where I'm allowed to own firearms and weapons so that I have the right to defend myself and my family because, you know, those people could have come to my house. So, you know, we're taking the training wheels off now and the Bitcoin way I know are the people that can get me there. And here's what I'd love to do, right, Scott? This is the plan, man. I got totally wiped out, straight back to zero, brutal experience. But I love Bitcoin and I know that this thing will make me financially free twice in one lifetime. And I know that despite starting at zero and everyone else thinks they're late to Bitcoin, I'm going to show them I'm also on zero and I've got to start from scratch. Let me show you what's possible. So I have no idea if I'm going to make it, Scott, and nobody does. But I'm going to try and find out and maybe show other people. Like maybe other people have got wrecked on the way. Like maybe I'll be the patron saint of wrecked plebs. And what we'll do, because how cool would that be if I get wiped out in 2024, but by 2034, I'm a fully sovereign individual? That would be kick ass, right? So hopefully we try and tell that story and encourage other people to just like, don't half-ass this, go all the way, you know?
Rick, I have no doubt this is your future. I I think a lot about the movie The Shawshank Redemption. And in that movie, he's got like a 30-year plan to get free, where he's taking a pebble at a time. And at the very end of it, he crawls through a sewer pipe for miles. It's a movie, right? But he ends up on a beach somewhere. And the path to freedom, I think, is different for everybody. But I'm so grateful for you to come on today and share us a little bit of your story and your experience. And so thank you so much for that.
No, man, it's an absolute pleasure. And like for anyone listening, like come on this journey, like let's get busy getting free, right? This is an opportunity that is once in a generation, maybe once in human history to really set yourself free. So like, let's go for it. I'm intimidated. I lost a bit of confidence after everything that happened, but like, man, look, if I can stick around and go for it, I think anybody can make it. So like, let's do it, man. And thank you for having me on. You know, I don't have anything to shill really or promote. I just want people to make it and I want them to be safe. So thank you for helping me share that.
And if you are listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in and hope to see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. BlockRewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.